This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have the studio with me Sean Faircloth. He's the author of Attack of the Theocrats, How the Religious Right Harms Us All and What We Can Do About It. There's a foreword by Richard Dawkins, and he is now with the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science. Sean Faircloth, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Great to be with you.
Tell me why you decided to write this book.
Well, I think one of the most important trends over the last 30 to 40 years in the United States has been the rise of the religious right, and in particular, their ability really now to have veto power over one of two major political parties in the United States. That's never happened before in American history, and I also think it's a dramatic combining trend. Actually, the recent death of Chuck Colson highlights this to some degree, where in the past, demographically, the Catholic Church, where I have some of my heritage, and the hard religious right, fundamentalist Protestant right, and then also Mormonism, have combined the three in a way that would have been unheard of, say, 40 years ago. And they intertwined, I think, are the single greatest religious power in the United States and have achieved this unprecedented success. You have to give them credit for an unprecedented success in their veto power over one of two major political parties in the United States.
It is amazing the power of religion and politics right now. And you mentioned coming out of the Catholic Church, you yourself, I'm wondering how you got from there to where you are.
Sure. Well, actually, even when I was young, I was never really religious. My father comes from an Irish Catholic background, but I remember he would watch the TV preachers that would come on back in those days, and he'd point at the TV and say, well, watch that guy, and hold on to your wallet. And so he always brought a skeptical view to things. And then it became crystallized for me in high school. I was very shy, type of kid, you know, bad acne, never talked to girls, this sort of thing. And I decided I'm going to overcome my shyness by trying out for the high school play. And I worked hard, and I was lucky to get the lead part in a play called Inherit the Wind about the Scopes Monkey Trials, which is meant that I had to memorize the lines of Clarence Darrow from that trial. And it affected my interest in becoming an attorney, which I did. And it really affected also a lot of my worldview and my skepticism.
Now, you went then into law after you you went to Notre Dame and then went to law school, and then you became a politician up in Maine, a state legislator. But tell me about that.
It was a great experience. I'm very proud of it. 10 years in politics. My last term, I was majority whip of the Maine legislature. There was real opportunities, at least in that era. Now there's a Tea Party governor in Maine, and things have changed. But during my time, you know, from the 90s into the last decade, I really felt like I could get things done. You could initiate legislation. I initiated over 30 pieces of legislation that made it to a governor's signature. And you could come up with progressive ideas and actually work them through a process. So it was very satisfying. But one of the things that started to repeatedly come up, and I was on the Judiciary Committee for 6 years, was the issue of the religious right. Even in Maine, I mean, Maine is not Alabama. It's not Mississippi, so it's not comparable in that respect. But nonetheless, the religious right was there. They were regularly represented. They were regularly lobbying. And the implication was, especially from a guy like me who was for, you know, marriage equality for gay people and women's reproductive choice and all this sort of thing, that the implication, they would use the word moral, and the implication was that my viewpoint was the not moral viewpoint, which got under my skin after a while. And I often thought, well, where's my viewpoint represented? You know, where is a secular viewpoint represented? And so I became increasingly energized by that concern, and really this book is kind of a product of that.
Now, you say in the book, and the book, again, is Attack of the Theocrats, How the Religious Right Harms Us All and What We Can Do About It. I'm Matt Rothschild, and speaking with the author of that book, Sean Faircloth, that you did the daily prayer once, though it wasn't exactly a prayer. What did you say in that daily prayer?
Well, as most of your listeners probably know, and pretty much I think every legislature in the country, they begin with a prayer. And usually it's some local clergy. I think it's sort of part of campaigning. Politicians, oh, well, Rabbi Jones or, you know, Minister X, whatever, they come in and then they tell all the people in their congregation, oh, you know, I got to do this in the legislature. So to me, it's sort of a form of campaigning, frankly. However, late in the session, a lot of times it gets busy. And so they'll haul up a politician to just cover it. And so, you know, a lot of times the legislators do it. I said, all right, I'll do it. And I did, I think I quoted from Susan Jacoby's book, Freethinkers, from Walt Whitman and Albert Einstein, I managed to cram in there. And one of the folks on the other side of the aisle wrote a note to the speaker and said, well, that's not a real prayer. And I had to concede, well, no, it really wasn't. But I figured it was good to offer a secular perspective, which is, you know, a similar and comparable population in the United States to African Americans. And I think it's worthy to have that viewpoint represented along with every other one.
Do you think it's wrong for legislators to have religious prayers starting the day?
It's not the most important concern I have. In my book, I document many, many laws that harm real people as a result of religious bias today in American law. But yeah, if it were up to me, no, I agree with James Madison, for whom, you know, Madison, Wisconsin is named, that he was adamant. He thought that having these kinds of invocations would lead to majority tyranny. And we've seen that, in fact, I think he was right. So I'd prefer not to have that. That's not my most important concern. In fact, I emphasize more the human impact concerns of religious bias in American law, many of which most people are not even aware of.
Well, let's pursue this a little further, Sean Faircloth, because you seem to be – you're making an argument here to your fellow secularists and fellow secularist organizations and leaders that they spend not so much time on the symbolic issues of prayer in the legislature or Christmas tree in the public park or wreath in the state capitol building or the mayor's office or In God We Trust on the coins. Why do you think these symbolic battles aren't so important?
Well, a couple reasons. One, as an attorney, if I were a judge, if they had me on the bench and those types of things came before me, I would strike most of what you've just described down. But that's not what I'm talking about in the book. I'm talking more about how to approach secular issues in a way that connects with a broader public. My thesis is that there are far more people than is currently perceived who share a secular perspective and certainly share a belief in the strict separation of church and state in this country. Yet the perception is that it's 50-50 almost, that especially because of the Republican Party and the way it works now, that somehow it's a split decision. I don't think it really is. I think most Americans are with those of us who want strong separation of church and state. So the question is, how do you reach those people to persuade them that this is a critical issue? And I frankly think that sometimes the symbolic issues become, if you're the average Joe or Jane out there and you're thinking, geez, I'm worried about the next paycheck or I'm worrying about really tough economic issues, why should I care if they have some manger in the town square at Christmas time and it seems a little bit of a side issue?
So how, in approaching secular issues, do you get them to the pocketbook issues?
Well, in terms of secular issues, what I describe in my book is some real human harm. Let me just take one example that's real important to me. I worked a lot on children's issues when I was in the legislature. And they have, and it's remarkable, in over 35 states, a separate standard. I used to be an assistant attorney general handling child protection cases back home in Maine for a brief time, handled hundreds of those cases over that brief period. And they literally have, in more than 35 states, a separate legal standard for so-called faith healing. But it's not faith healing. In real life, unfortunately, it's faith harming and in some extreme cases that happen regularly, faith killing. And I describe many of those cases, horrific cases, little kids with huge tumors coming out of their face and horrible, torturous pain, worse than anything that ever happened at Abu Ghraib, and nobody knows about it. And yet the government literally steps in. This is not the Constitution here. This is a statute passed by over 35 legislatures that say there's a more lenient standard for so-called faith-healing parents that doesn't apply to the rest of us. That's just one example. But whether you're talking about land use planning, which people would not perceive as a religious issue, but there's a federal law that provides special privileges for religions, not for your 501c3 nonprofit, not for your for-profit business, not for your individual, but for religions that can violate environmental laws and land use planning laws. It's crazy talk. And then to economic issues, you mentioned that, and one that really sticks out for me is something called the parsonage exemption, which a lot of people are not aware of. And it didn't matter that much back in 1970. In 1970, there were less than 100 of what we now call megachurches, 2,000 or more on a Sunday. Now there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these churches. Each one will have 3, 4, 5 ministers, and every minister gets the amount of their income that's attributable to their housing exempt from income tax. We'd all love to have that, but only they get it. And some of these folks live in some real serious mansions that we're helping to subsidize. I call it the religio-industrial complex. They have a huge economic motivation, usually to preach hate against gay people or tell women they need to be subordinate, which they're welcome to that viewpoint. But I don't want to be subsidizing that with my tax dollars.
And they could help us on budget issues if they were paying their taxes. There's also the question about their tax exemption period, the
right.
church's tax exemption, especially when they're doing electioneering. And sometimes they're doing blatant electioneering and getting away with it.
Now, they should be in violation. They are in violation if they're actually preaching to endorse a candidate from the pulpit. That's not supposed to happen, or you lose your IRS exemption. But I want to give you another couple examples about this tax code issue and how they're able to play the system. You mentioned about endorsing from the pulpit. There was a case of a church, and a relatively unknown fundamentalist church, endorsing a candidate, or allegedly endorsing a candidate for office. And the IRS local office, I guess, went and said, hey, we want to audit you to find out what you're up to here, because we're hearing these stories about you doing this, which could mean you'd lose your tax deductibility. The church correctly brought up a law that was passed under Ronald Reagan that said unless you have a so-called high IRS official to bring the audit, it's not valid. And so they didn't argue about whether or not they were doing the substance of what they were alleged to do. No, they were just saying you didn't have a high enough IRS official, therefore you lose, and they won that suit because they're right. That is on the books. So, you know, your listeners can be assured that any old IRS official will do to audit them. But when it's a church, they have this extra threshold that must be met. And the irony of the story was the obscure politician that they were alleged to have endorsed back 10, 15 years ago turned out to be Michelle Bachmann, not so obscure now. But you see, when you have these churches actively being involved in politics, ministers that not just the church, but they themselves get money in their own pocket through this parsonage exemption, and they don't have to file a 990. For your listeners who know, if you have a 501c3 nonprofit, you got to file the 990. The churches don't, and they're really like a financial black box. You can't see the finances. The ministers benefit personally from the finances, and it's difficult to audit them. That is really a scary combination in what I call the religio-industrial complex, and something people need to know more about.
And you'll find out more about it by reading this book, Attack of the Theocrats, How the Religious Right Harms Us All and What We Can Do About It. The author, right here speaking with me, is Sean Faircloth. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. This, of course, is Progressive Radio. During the Catholic Church pedophile scandal, I used to think that, wow, if this was not a religious organization, this whole entity would be put up on RICO charges because they were just sending the offending priests to other parishes to continue their work. And it was just amazing to me that the church was able to dodged the law for the longest time. Didn't that strike you as odd?
It's horrific. And to me, you just pointed to what I think is the key issue. I give a speech on YouTube called, I think it's Catholicism, Contraception, and Morality at Notre Dame at my old school, and discuss some of these very points. And for me, the key issue is the administrative decision-making. I started a children's museum back home in Maine, and it was a great experience and a wonderful time and really enriching, I hope, for the kids that went there. But in that situation, of course, you had adults, employees who had access to children. And I would hope, luckily nothing during my time there ever came up along those lines, but I would hope that if someone were ever to say, you know, here's an allegation, a concern of child abuse, that right away you report it to the authorities and you segregate that person from access to children until the matter is resolved. That's common sense. But yet, here we have administrators of a business. It's just a business like any other business as far as I'm concerned in the Catholic Church. And these people who are the administrators of the business say, we know the guy. In one case, Father Paul Shanley was saying positive things about something called the Man-Boy Love Association, which, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that doesn't sound like a good thing. And So they knew that he had expressed these positive things about this organization, and yet they transferred him from Parish A to Parish B to Parish C. This is beyond the pedophile itself. It's the administrative decision-making of this organization that really is I would say, there's a valid issue of whether it's criminality in this type of conduct. And that doesn't say anything negative about the good, decent folks who are Catholic, but it does say something about the hierarchy of that church and their moral responsibility or lack thereof.
Sean Faircloth, you mentioned the contraception a couple seconds ago. There is this crazy time warp going on in the United States in 2012 here with rolling back the clock on the freedom of women to use contraception. And that is overwhelmingly religious-based, that move. And yet, doesn't it just seem so strange to you that here we are in 2012, we're having this discussion? I love the sign of the woman. I saw it on the internet. She held up a sign that said, "I can't believe I still have to be protesting this junk," though she didn't use the word junk. But
right.
I mean, it is crazy, isn't it?
Well, it is, I think, central to the divergence between the religious right, which now includes much of the Catholic hierarchy. There used to be a tradition of sort of the Catholic left, but that's largely died away. You know, sort of gone from Kennedy Catholics to Scalia Catholics, and that's really the dominant force certainly in the hierarchy of the church nowadays. And so those combined forces really have an obsession. There's no other way to put it, in my view, about sex. And I have a chapter in my book specifically about it because I think it's so important. Because so much of what the religious right, and again, I'm really combining fundamentalist Protestant, the Catholic right, and Mormonism, so much of what they focus upon has to do with sexuality and a rigid and bizarre retrograde view that really is ironic. Given that, you know, if you went back 40 years, it seems like we've slipped backwards in time because in 1970 or, you know, in that era, some of this stuff would have been absurd that they're even discussing it. And now they're literally out there. I see politicians who will say that they would think it would be okay for a legislature to make contraception illegal. And that doesn't sound like in the Republican Party, it doesn't sound like to me a party of, you know, libertarianism and personal choice.
Yeah, I mean, that was Rick Santorum's view. And, he was the front runner for a second and then second place finisher. How'd you respond when he talked about JFK's famous speech when JFK was running for president and talked beautifully, in my mind, about the separation of church and state because there Kennedy was being called a papist and that he was going to be, ruling from the White House and doing whatever the Pope told him to do. And so he was trying to deflect that. But in the process, he gave a great constitutional discussion. Santorum said it wanted to make him vomit.
Right. It's fascinating to me because I wrote my book before Santorum's statements. And at that time, for people who were historically knowledgeable, they knew of Kennedy's Houston speech. But it's interesting what a prominent role this speech from 52 years ago is playing in a campaign in 2012. And Kennedy's speech is very significant. One of the things that I admire about him and about Martin Luther King, a minister, interestingly, is that they both were actually, they followed through. Kennedy seemed to follow through on his separation of church and state viewpoint while in office. When the Supreme Court came down with its ruling during his presidency to take out government-orchestrated prayer in public schools, Kennedy basically said, "Well, you can pray on the weekend." He kind of said, "Let the decision stand." He didn't attack it. Martin Luther King, interestingly, commenting on the same ruling, said something that I think that it should be plastered everywhere and on the internet everywhere. Is Dr. King said, "Well, you know, people want to pray, they can pray, but I'd rather have people, children be required to read the Bill of Rights every morning in school." And that makes a lot more sense to me. It's a secular viewpoint in terms of separation of church and state. And that's one thing I hope to provide in my book. It's kind of a toolkit is the way I thought of the book. Is it gives a viewpoint of the founders through to more recently with JFK and others about our separation of church and state tradition. For those who want to answer, for your listeners who want to answer this unfortunately rather successful propaganda campaign from the religious right to say we were founded as a Christian nation, well, I try to concisely refute that so you can talk to your friends and neighbors about it. Then I try to offer a concise summary of these many different laws that have religious bias that hurt real people so it can't be dismissed as just about the manger and the town square. And then I try to offer another part of the toolkit, which is a plan for the future, for a secular future, which is what we need to rejuvenate in this country.
Speaking with Sean Faircloth, the book he's referring to, there is Attack of the Theocrats, How the Religious Right Harms Us All and What We Can Do About It. He is now with the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science. And Richard Dawkins has written a really neat foreword to this book. What's Richard Dawkins like?
He is a really impressive and kind-hearted guy. He gets a lot of heat, I think, because for those who might not know, he's a very prominent scientist. His book, The Selfish Gene, is a landmark book in science. And many say that after Darwin himself, he is the premier evolutionary biologist in that field. Then he wrote a book much more recently called The God Delusion, which makes a case for lack of belief in God and for atheism. That has certainly put him in some controversial waters. But I think that a lot of time a stereotyping of him occurs because I've been his opening speaker for a couple of book tours now, and which is very generous of him because the guy can draw, you know, 2,000 people into a room and it's exciting to go. It's really like a political rally. I've never talked to more people other than I did a welcome for Obama in Maine one time. But other than that, I mean, the biggest crowds I've ever seen. But he gets attacked. And I think a lot of times not legitimately, because I think what he speaks for is compassion. And when I talk about the way children are harmed by religious bias in law, not just by religious people, but by religious bias in law, he really emphasizes a point that I share passionately. And that is that children shouldn't be stamped. You shouldn't be able to take away a child's human rights by labeling them Catholic or fundamentalist or what have you. Just to take another trend that has sort of gone under the radar to some degree in America is back before the 1980s, most private schools had to have certified teachers. State law required it. There was like wildfire during the Reagan era. They passed a lot of laws saying they didn't need to be certified. And some of the curriculum that you get, and we're talking about millions of children who get fundamentalist education in the United States, are really getting some horrifically bad education, some flat-out lies on things like the origin of the universe and science and other things. And some, many, we're talking, you know, many girls taught in this country that girls are to be subordinate as part of a philosophy of education. That really is horrific to be happening in 2012. And I think we need to know more, the public needs to know more about what's happening to the human rights of these children.
Speaking with Sean Faircloth, he's the author of a very impressive book called Attack of the Theocrats, How the Religious Right Harms Us All and What We Can Do About It. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. This is Progressive Radio. You also have a chapter in here where you name names, the fundamentalist 50 legislators, people in Congress who are really far out there. Can you give me two or three favorites?
Well, and by the way, I said fundamentalist 50 just to for alliteration purposes. I could have named a lot more. The number of sitting members of Congress, I believe the evidence is clear, is a higher percentage than ever before in American history of people who flat out will advocate for things that are essentially theocratic. I'm not saying we live in a theocracy now, but I'm saying there are enough people in office today that have this viewpoint that makes it a real significant threat. There are so many examples. I'll give you one. There's a member of Congress, Steve Pierce, I believe his name is, from New Mexico. Someone, again, most people probably would never have heard of him. But just to sort of show how the mind of some of these folks work, he talked about the issue of gay marriage. And his explanation, in addition to supporting some form of religious viewpoint on this, that, you know, as is so often the case, that somehow God says no to treating gay people equally. But that in addition to that, he said, well, if you allowed for this, it would have bad downstream effects. And I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially said, well, that someone could get the idea. For instance, in California, he said, because it's because of health care coverage or something in California, that somebody, if you had gay marriage, then you could have polygamous marriage. And then somebody could marry all the gay people with AIDS. And then, well, then they'd get all that health care coverage from that. And it was actually seemed to imply that somehow getting health care coverage for people with AIDS would be a bad result. I'm thinking, well, why would that be bad anyway? But nonetheless, he thought this was some nefarious scheme that could possibly lead to polygamous marriage that would therefore do this. And the I guess what I'd say is the tinfoil, you know, hat-wearing crowd that's in Congress. Congress is kind of supposed to be important, you know, 535 people that represent 300 million Americans, and they just, there's so many flat-out loony statements and religious motivation. And for me, there's, I always get the question, well, do you think they're hypocrites or do you think they're fanatics? And I guess for me in the end, I don't know, and it's somewhat irrelevant in that what matters is they're willing to vote it. And whether they're voting it as hypocrites or voting it as fanatics, the end result is the same for the rest of us. And unlike Santorum, who gets so much media attention, understandably, or people like that, I think we need to shine more light, and that's what I try to do in my book, on these rank-and-file members of Congress and legislatures to show this is a big issue. And even if Barack Obama wins an election in 2012, these people are all still going to be here, and we need to do something about that.
And one of them, you gave the award, the Michelle Bachmann is Moderate Award, to Congresswoman Vicky Hertzler of Missouri.
All right.
She supported legislation that would have allowed for prosecutors to charge women who obtained late-term abortions with murder. I mean, it's just, this is where we are. Of course, Tom Coburn thought, wanted to do the same thing there from Oklahoma.
Oh, there's lots of examples from multiple states. So when you get the book, you can kind of use it to talk to friends wherever they live and point some of these issues out. And I think it is important that we call people out on these questions. I mean, the governor of Wisconsin has gone on and said, you know, how every decision he makes is somehow guided by a religious viewpoint. He's welcome to that opinion, I suppose. But to me, I think it's problematic. And as I point out in my book, deeply antithetical, if you will, to the viewpoint of people like Jefferson and Madison, who were so skeptical about religion being in any way involved in government. They were much more strong on church-state separation than, frankly, we see from Obama himself today.
Right, and it was a problem in the administration of George W. Bush because he said he was following orders from on high, too. And, you know, once they pull out the God card, you really can't have a rational argument. You can't say, well, this policy's bad, that policy's good. No, this policy's from God, he says.
Right, and that is the odd inoculation, that somehow if you raise some kind of religious perspective that we're all supposed to back off and not question the logic. And my book, in large part, is questioning that premise. And I will give one that's somewhat of a criticism of Barack Obama, who, you know, I'm as an individual, I'm happy to say, you know, support him before and will again. But, for instance, he went out of his way to talk about Billy Graham and speak positively of Billy Graham. And he has continued faith-based initiatives. In faith-based initiatives, which he promised in 2008 he would eliminate, but faith-based initiatives, literally, they fired people with tax money who are the wrong type of fundamentalist. They've said, you're fired because you're not our exact right type of fundamentalist, you're fired. They turned away a guy who was a Muslim from a financial job because he was a Muslim. You know, with tax money, it's insanity. But back to Billy Graham, recently, Barack Obama really went out of his, bent over backwards to say all these nice things about Billy Graham. Well, do we have a sense of knowledge of history where Billy Graham talked about the synagogues of Satan, where he really said, "I'm to his close friend Richard Nixon, I'm worried about what the Jews are doing to this country." No other person who'd said such blatantly anti-Semitic thing would get away with something like that, except he's a minister. And when you're a minister, you get this thing over you that's an imprimatur that allows you to get away with this stuff. We got to change that.
Mm-hmm. And Sean Faircloth will show you how to change that if you read his book, Attack of the Theocrats, How the Religious Right Harms Us All and What We Can Do About It. Thanks so much for being my guest today, Sean.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.